from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last month when the Journal of American Medical Association released a new study on children's rates of victimization by violence. And we're going to talk about what violence means in just a moment. The numbers, even in longtime professionals in the field, were staggering. The prevalence of violence has a significant impact on children's physical and mental health, and as you might guess, that can do lasting damage to their future. Now, it might be easy for you or for any of us to say, there's no violence in my household, that is not my problem. But this hour, we look at who's impacted and how it can impact all of us and what we can do to stop it. My guests for the hour include Dr. Jeff Kazarowski. He is the president of the Children's Agenda and a pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital. And Dr. Kazarowski, it's good to have you back.
Thank you.
Sherry Toth is here, the director of the Mount Hope Family Center, professor of psychology at the University of Rochester, and someone who has studied various prongs of this issue for a while herself. So we'll be talking about that. It's nice to have you, Sherry.
Thank you.
And also here is Jerome Underwood, senior director of youth development and family services at the Rochester City School District. Jerome, nice to have you.
Thank you very much, Evan.
Just before the program started, I relayed the fact that this morning I heard from a listener who said, violence with children, but do you mean violence committed against children personally or children witnessing violence? And Jerome, I want to start right there because you immediately looked at me and you said, it's both.
It's absolutely both. Children experience violence. They see it and it traumatizes them. And obviously, when they experience it as being a victim of violence, that even more traumatizes them. So we're talking about the experience in vicarious trauma. So it's definitely both.
Dr. Kazarowski, when we see new numbers and new studies, it's not anything new that violence can hurt a child physically, but also hurt their chances long term to have a happy life, to have an emotionally stable life. What's new to you? What stands out?
I think what's really important is that violence is now the leading cause of injury and death for children. It outclipses things like birth defects, asthma, cancer. It's really important that we start to work on this issue and implement things that we know are effective for kids.
My feeling when I see violence as the number one leading cause now is we are morally failing, if that's true. Do you disagree?
I agree. We're a very violent society, and it takes a tremendous toll on children. And Sherry is really an expert about its impact for children. But the other critical thing to understand is that it influences your health for a lifetime. So it's not just about that kid being injured or assaulted or hurt. It's not even just about the mental health issues that go along with an experience like that if you survive it, but it is about adult health. So heart disease, liver disease are linked to the experience of violence when you're a kid.
Boy, it's more than we always think of behavioral relationship, but it's so many things more than that. And Sherry, what stands out to you from this? I want to talk about your research as well. What stands out to you, and what do you want our listeners to sort of start this conversation with as we look at the problem?
Sure. One thing that I think is particularly troubling is that in the city of Rochester, we recently did a study, and 60% of the children living in economically disadvantaged families had significant exposure to violence, including child abuse and neglect, witnessing domestic violence, and observing significant violence in their communities.
Are we at a point now, can you put a number on it, or at least an expectation that kids who witness violence in their household, even if they're just growing up and I say just, but I'm not even talking about physically them being abused. I'm talking about witnessing domestic violence, a spouse violent to another spouse. Do we know just how much that impacts their chances of being violent later in life?
Very, very high. And of children who witness or experience violence, I'd say pretty close to 90% of them experience some form of significant problems in childhood that continue into the school, that continue into romantic relationships, and then contributes to the intergenerational transmission of violence.
We're at a point now where you would think that violence is no longer at the top of the list or not moving to the top of the list for the cause of death and injury in children. And Dr. Kazurowski, for example, what are the other things that, when you talk about the tragic story of children dying, it shouldn't be violent, but you know, there are many other things that you would think by now our society would be so much better at dealing with this. How do you stay, you know, encouraged about this?
I have colleagues like Jerome and Sherry, and there's a lot we can do. There are a lot of effective solutions, and some of them we're achieving here in Rochester, both in terms of prevention, things that keep this violence and trauma from happening to kids, and in terms of intervention, once it's happened, because it's happening to so many kids, we also need to do things that help them to heal and to do better. And there's, I think what keeps me optimistic is that we are able to do things to change this problem. And Rochester, in some ways, is a leader in terms of evidence-based models to work on this. Sherry's work at Mount Hope Family Center is world-renowned. The Nurse Family Partnership was invented here in Rochester. The Building Healthy Children program, another approach to helping young families and parents who need support and have experienced trauma, is a national model program now, all of it having its roots and origins here in Rochester. And there's a big gap between what we know and even what the experience that we have in terms of expertise and what we do here in Rochester. We've got to do more.
All right, so let's at least understand part of the problem. Kids in poverty, kids with parents who are violent to each other, much more likely to experience violence themselves. Not exclusively, it doesn't mean it certainly doesn't mean it never happens elsewhere. And Jeff, do we focus too narrowly on this sometimes?
I think we do. These things are connected. It's really important to realize that poverty and violence are connected. Poverty is stress. It's stressful to families. And when any of us are under stress, when I'm under stress, I tend to behave in ways that I necessarily regret. But if you can imagine being under the stress of not being able to feed your child 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, the impact that can have in terms of behavior and in terms of trauma and violence. But on the other hand, Evan, you know, the JAMA study, the Journal of the American Medical Association study, showed that for all kids, not just for kids who are poor, violence was incredibly common. 40% of all kids, and the majority of those reported being assaulted, physically assaulted, in the course of a year.
40% of all kids.
40%. And that was across the socioeconomic spectrum.
Yes.
Now, Sherry's work demonstrates that certainly that kids who are living in poverty experience significantly more violence. So if you look at that JAMA number of 40% and then look at her work here in Rochester and realize that we're talking about 60% of kids, that indicates that there's more of a problem in areas that have poverty and in areas that have repeatedly seen generational violence. But it's still a common problem for everyone, for every kid.
All right, so 60%, Sherry, in Rochester,
yes,
kids? That's what our research shows us?
Yes. And I think another really important point to keep in mind is that those children who are experiencing trauma are living with parents who themselves have had significant histories of trauma. So you're really seeing that intergenerational transmission of violence, and then parents who have been so impaired by their experiences that for them to parent effectively is very difficult, and for them to be a resource for their children, to encourage their children to go to school and succeed, is also very difficult.
Jerome, I've been in the Hall of Justice for too many sad cases. I've seen those vacant gazes of toddlers walking around. They should never be seeing that. But I've also been around when you've got a 19-year-old on trial for an act of violence. And so, you know, what I hear from people who don't know this person is, oh, lock him up, that terrible guy, much worse than that, as opposed to saying, you know, not that what this person did is okay, but is anybody surprised? If you peel back that onion, you go back to childhood, the person's abused, he's seeing violence, and I think we have to be very careful about that.
It's the exact manifestation of what Sherry's talking about, because that 19-year-old... it's very likely that he or she, and I got to say she because we see the increase in females committing violent acts. It just didn't happen yesterday. there's generational violence, the generational trauma that that individual is internalizing, and that almost becomes a way of living. And it's sad. You said earlier, you asked the question, you know, are we morally missing this? I think we are, because with respect to, you know, our friends and relatives who live out in the suburbs, they can't afford, in my opinion, to draw the drapes on this. Because when people wonder, well, why is the Rochester City School District having such poor outcomes? And we talk about what Sheree said just now, 60%. We think the number is underreported because the children who are experiencing violence, they're not going to come to school and report it. They're not going to tell somebody because of the shame associated with domestic violence or any other, or even violence against themselves. So when you see that 19-year-old, Evan, in the Hall of Justice, it's a culmination of a lot of really, really bad stuff. And we, the collective we, the big we, all of us who live in this nine-county area, we need to be first aware. So I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity to talk about this, because it's a, it's very, very serious, and the implications for long-term effects on young people are vast.
We're talking to Jerome Underwood, who is the Senior Director of Youth Development and Family Services at the Rochester City School District, Sheree Toth, the Director of the Mount Hope Family Center and a Professor of Psychology at the University of Rochester, and Dr. Jeff Kazarowski, President of the Children's Agenda and Pediatrician at Golisano Children's Hospital, on the question of the impact of violence on our children. And Jerome, I think about, you know, I think about a listener who might think, this is not my issue, you know. There's not violence in my home. But your kid goes to school. Your kid hopefully goes to school in a diverse setting, meets people from across the spectrum, has life experiences. And your children may interact with other kids who are undergoing violence, seeing violence, living with that. And there are effects on all of us, I think, beyond just saying, as you use the term, drawing the curtain or drawing the shade. If we think it's not our problem, I fear that it becomes all of society's problem.
There's no question, because a lot of violence, certainly in the city, it's like poverty, to Jeff's point, it is concentrated. We know where it's happening. 14605, the Crescent, 14621, the Northeast. We know it's happening, but that's not the only place it's happening. And that's why we continue to work with these young people and their families, because if we don't, when we consider the alternative of that young man or young lady deciding that they're going to commit an act of violence, it's not just in the city. They may venture out, as many have done. I remember I witnessed this myself on the Mount Reed Wegmans. I live not far from there. And it was late one night, and three young men took a drive, and they decided that they were going to rob that store. I was there. I was there, and I actually followed through on that and went to Greasetown Court to experience, to see for myself how this was going to play out, and ended up speaking on behalf of those children. When I say speaking on behalf of them, because I found out who their parents were. They were chronically absent from school, and part of their rehabilitation, if you will, as opposed to punishment, was trying to get them in school all the time. So back to your directly to your question, it's going to come to you. Hopefully not, but it's likely, because, you know, hurt people hurt people. You know, and Sheree and Jeff, you know, they're the clinical folks here, Sheree in particular, but it doesn't know any boundary. And what it costs us, all of us as taxpayers, to, in with respect to incarceration and trying to get this little boy, this little girl right, we want to start shifting some of those dollars into prevention. And some of that work is carrying on now in the school district, where we're training school psychologists and social workers on trauma-informed care, because so many of our students are exposed to trauma, and try to teach them the kind of resilience that they need to resist those temptations or what may seem as natural instincts to be violent. So it's all of us, and we need all hands on deck. First of all, the awareness. And then what do we do? As Jeff mentioned, there's got to be action to follow up, not just talk.
Listeners, we'd love to hear from you on this. Your thoughts on the way violence impacts children what we can do about it, the long-term effects. It's 844-295-TALK. That number is toll-free, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can email the program. You can find us at wxxinews.org/connections. Communicate through the show online or at Evan Dawson on Twitter. And Dr. Kazurowski has been saying and said before the show began that one of the emphasis points you want to make here is that this is not just an abstract problem that should bring us all down, that there are things that can be done. I mean, all of our panelists on this program right now are building their careers on doing something.
Yeah.
But what? I mean, there's a lot that's happening, but what else needs to happen right now?
Well, there are things that can happen both in the health setting and in the community setting. And along the entire spectrum of childhood. And also, it's really important what Sherry was talking about in terms of the generational nature of this, that we work with parents and families who have experienced trauma and violence to help them so that they don't replicate that cycle, so that it doesn't happen for kids in their family. That their hurt doesn't mean that they're hurting others. Starting with parenting support programs, nurse family partnership and building healthy children are evidence-based community prevention programs that work really well. The Children's Institute has been a leader in terms of preventive programs in preschool and elementary school. Programs like PATHS, Promoting Alternative Thinking Strategies, Primary Project, invented here in Rochester, Coping Power. These are all programs that are based on the fact that we know that 40 to 60% of kids are experiencing significant violence in the course of a year, and try and get at the roots of that and be helpful with that. There's a lot we can do. And from a health standpoint, there's probably no one better to talk to than Sherry, because the work that they do at Mount Hope is among the most effective work done in the United States on this issue.
Well, Sherry, direct to you then a question we had from a listener. We actually have a couple of comments that just came in on Twitter. One listener saying, I'm listening to Evan Dawson's show on child poverty and violence, and I'm basically crying in my car. It's definitely a rural problem as well, she says. And again, I think that's an important point to keep emphasizing. This is not just in concentrated poverty neighborhoods, et cetera. And then Cindy writes to the program and says, what kind of violence can you be more specific, and do you include corporal punishment?
I'll answer the first part of that question first. I think it's really important that we highlight that there are things that work, and that we really need to be putting community resources into those programs that we know work, such as Jeff mentioned, Nurse Family Partnership, the Building Healthy Children program, which is very much of a basic prevention program. We identify young women who've had their first child prior to the age of 21 who are living in poverty, and we reach out to them in the pediatric setting to get them enrolled in the program. We've gotten some really great results from that. Already it's funded by the United Way and Monroe County Department of Human Services, and we're finding that young moms who participate in that program, their parents' skills are improving, their children are more up to date on immunizations and well child visits, the mothers are feeling better about their parenting, which is really huge because they're then more effective. And also very many of these young women have significant levels of depression, so we're able to treat that depression as well. So we're improving the parent-child relationship, also maternal self-sufficiency, helping these young women get jobs, helping them finish their educations that they may not have finished. So that's really huge. So I know it's very upsetting to talk about this issue, and I think it's understandable to get very teary-eyed about it. But I do want the take-home message to be that we have things that work and we need to be doing more of them. The second part of the question about the types of violence that we're talking about, really across the spectrum. We're talking about child abuse and neglect, which is a lot of what my work has focused on. We're talking about exposure to domestic violence. We're talking about witnessing shootings in the neighborhood. So it really cuts the spectrum. And I think it was in the JAMA article, Jeff, that said that about six or more traumas these children have experienced, which is just mind-blowing. In our work at Mount Hope, we're seeing very similar levels to that. Not one trauma, not two, but multiple wow. ones over the course of early childhood.
Cindy wanted to know, and we're going to get to Gretchen's phone call in just a second, on a different question about what constitutes abuse. Corporal punishment, is that a separate conversation?
There's a lot of disagreement on whether corporal punishment is or isn't acceptable. And I think that when we're talking about abuse, we're not talking about corporal punishment. We're not about, you know, spanking a child on the bottom, if that's what you believe is appropriate. We're talking about punishment that crosses the threshold, that leaves bruises, that disfigures children, that has significant lifetime consequences for them, both emotionally, physically, and more we're seeing that it affects their physiology.
Gretchen in Rochester. Go ahead, Gretchen.
Yeah, hi. For the purposes of this discussion, I was wondering if you're including verbal abuse, stemming from lack of conflict resolution skills, but verbal abuse, spouses fighting, the yelling at children that you see in the grocery store, and that are you including that when you're talking about violence?
We are including that, but what we see typically is there's not a single type of abuse that occurs. So we're seeing neglect, we're seeing physical abuse, we're seeing emotional abuse, and they co-occur at very, very high rates.
Okay. Dr. Kazurowski, any thoughts on that?
The JAMA article really didn't try and measure verbal abuse. So if we added that, it may even be more striking in terms of the findings. I feel like as the pediatrician, I have to say corporal punishment, spanking kids, isn't effective. And we shouldn't be encouraging parents to do that. I understand that there are different parenting styles, but it's not effective. And it probably, there's some evidence to indicate that it actually can be harmful.
Okay.
Isn't a continuous verbal abuse just as destructive, but isn't that destructive as well?
Yeah. Yeah, no question. I think Sherry's point is these things go together. Verbal abuse is certainly very destructive. All of these things take away your self-esteem. They take away the sense that you're a competent person or a good person. And once you've lost that, it's very hard to recover. And so I totally agree. It just may not, the only point I was making is it just may not be measured in some of the studies because it's harder to come by. It's easier to ask and to document other kinds of trauma.
Mm-hmm. Jane, go ahead, Jane.
Yes. One thing in reading about children and crimes committed against them is often the predator parent, and if a parent's doing it, they're predators to me. But they often so terrorize a child that he doesn't tell or she doesn't tell, and they say, if you tell, I'll hurt your sister or I'll kill your mother, things like that. And so it doesn't, unlike other crimes, the child may just be terrorized into silence. And so that keeps that going on, and I wonder, what in the world can we do to, when they do tell, to reassure them that that parent won't be back in their life? Because I've read of instances where they've, you know, you've got to establish the probability that crime actually happened. What happens? I know the children were removed from the home, but if that child thinks that parent is going to again have access to them, they're not going to tell. And can you just tell me something about that we could reassure children that if you do stand up and you do speak, we will protect you from this person? Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Yeah, Jerome Underwood's the Senior Director of Youth Development and Family Services at the Rochester City School District. Go ahead, Jerome.
Jane, you're absolutely correct, and we alluded to that slightly, but you're amplifying the fact of the numbers that we think, the local numbers, are understated because of exactly what you're mentioning. And in terms of action, I mentioned earlier, certainly at the school district, we have this informed trauma care that we teaching to our school psychologists, social workers, and also administration to, you know, and what do we do then? The practical application of that is digging into a child's mind, if you will, having conversation to sort of free up those things. And not only the child, but even some of the parents too, to, you know, have them be as honest with us as possible. Because, you know, our teachers and the social workers, they know the children. And if Jerome is a little quiet today or all week, it necessitates some conversation. And what we're finding is exactly as you say is what's happening. So, of course, we're mandated court reporters, and we take violence of all kinds very, very, very seriously. So that's how we're looking to address that, or not looking to. That's how we address the silence or the unreported violence and trauma that we know is happening with children.
I think it's also important to highlight that when maltreatment occurs, that does not necessarily mean that a child is removed from the family. And in fact, in Rochester, rates of placement in foster care have actually decreased in recent years. But we have interventions, as Jeff mentioned, that we work with that family, with the parent, with the child together to ensure that maltreatment does not occur in the future, and to work on trying to repair the damage that has occurred as a result of the maltreatment.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the impact of violence on children. A new study finding 40% of children experience it. It is the number one cause of death in our children. And it is not limited only to urban settings, impoverished neighborhoods, though certainly it is most acute in those settings, and it is a very, very serious long-term concern. So we've been talking about the problem. I want to, after this short break, come back and tell you about more of the things that are already happening that you might not be aware of. You know, for example, you think of a 6-year-old, an 8-year-old, somebody who's gone through trauma of some kind. How do you work with them? You know, there are trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapies. There are things that are happening if we can identify the problems and if we can get the kids in that setting to get the help. There is a chance to start making things better. I want to tell you about that after this short break right here in Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Harper Lee's new book, Ghosts at a Watchman, is out on Tuesday, and already longtime fans of To Kill a Mockingbird are upset. It turns out Atticus Finch, in his later years, is a segregationist and a racist. They say this doesn't fit with the theme. Was it the wrong idea to publish it? Then we're talking about how to eradicate AIDS by 2020. Join us Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. And Jerome Underwood with the City Rochester City School District. As we talk about child violence, I know every case of violence is tragic and potentially long-lasting, but there are a couple of incidents especially on your mind right now. What are they?
Indeed. The two names I want to lift up, Quadri Henderson Speed, who was, you know, just a couple of weeks from graduation, just last month, who was murdered. This was in the news. People may have heard of that. We also lost another young man earlier in the year, Jonah Hussein, who was 12 years old. And this, in this case, unfortunately, it was a suicide. In Jonah's case, about a month ago, I had the honor of speaking at their sixth grade moving up ceremony. And his classmates did a tribute to him that there wasn't a dry eye in the room. So when we talk about the effect of violence on children, it is profound. And it's deep. In Quadri's case, you know, his family went to the graduation ceremony. That was extremely brave and courageous of them. But the impact, and again, this vicarious trauma on his classmates who may have not, of course, didn't witness his murder, or in Jonah's case, didn't witness his suicide. It impacts them deeply because all of a sudden you have a kid who is, not next to you anymore. And the impact of that is profound on children and long-lasting.
You talk about what can you do. One of our other guests is Sherry Toth, who's the director of the Mount Hope Family Center, professor of psychology at the University of Rochester. And just to remind you of the work that Sherry has done, your work focused on the effects of violence, specifically child abuse and neglect. And your research looked at 500 8 to 12-year-olds in Rochester. 60% had significant trauma in their lives, defined as seeing someone shot on the street, having experienced sexual assault or physical assault, having experienced abuse or neglect, witnessing domestic violence. 60%. Jerome has said he thinks that might still be mildly underreported. And so it's a huge number of kids experiencing this. But I want to try to focus on some of the hope that could come from the good outcomes, the better outcomes, the improvement that could happen. So, for example, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy, kids age 6 through adolescence, what happens?
Basically, you work with the child individually to help them articulate the trauma and to help them work through the effects of that on how it has affected their thinking, how it affects their behavior. We very much involve the parents in that treatment as well, because often these children have not even been able to share with their parents what they've experienced, and therefore the parents can't really help them. So really working with the parent and child together to look at that trauma and how the child can move forward successfully.
Two quick questions on that. I assume they come in, you're seeing them because it's a significant enough trauma. You say the parents might not even be aware of it, but it must be something very significant for you to have it on your radar.
Absolutely. We get a lot of our referrals from the Department of Human Services with children who've been traumatized. We also have increasingly been working with children in military families. So sometimes you have a parent who, even if they might be aware of it, they're not quite able to deal with it. So they're kind of denying the impact that that trauma can have on their child. We often hear, oh, the child was 3 or 4 when they witnessed their father being shot. They're not going to remember that. But we know that that's not true. We know that it has profound effects on the child. We have some recent work that one of my graduate students just completed, looking at a model of therapy, child-parent psychotherapy, where you work with the parent and the child together. We provided this intervention to mothers when their children were in their infancy, and we recently did a follow-up when these children were between 9 and 12 years old, and we're finding that the positive relationship effects from early on have now generalized to the peer relationships that these children are having between 9 and 12 years of age, and they're having positive peer relations. So it's a really exciting intervention that shows beginning in infancy up through middle school that it is having a positive effect.
Do they have to be willing to talk about it? That's part of this process?
Well, in infancy, they're not going to talk
But 6 through adolescence?
6 through adolescence, yes. And again, sometimes the children are less able to come in and sit down and say, this is what happened to me. So you use different modalities. You can use artwork with them. You can use storytelling and just help them feel comfortable enough, develop that relationship so that ultimately they're able to start building a narrative with the therapist that ultimately can be shared with a significant caregiver in their life. Sometimes that caregiver might not be a parent if the parent's not ready. We might pull a teacher in that has a close relationship with that child so that the child really has somebody that they can share it with, that they trust, and then they can move forward from that.
And once they're talking about it, are you intervening in any other ways that seeks to curb behavior or potential behavior? Is it just simply the process of dialogue and building something constructive off that? How do you try to work to head off these problems that are almost certainly coming as a result of their trauma?
Certainly. A lot of the children that have been referred to us are already having significant problems in school, acting out aggressive behaviors, and you try to help them understand how the trauma they've experienced is affecting their thinking and then how that's factoring into their behavior. So the goal is very much to decrease that aggressive behavior, to help them develop more trust in teachers, in a significant other adult in their life. We know that children who are resilient, meaning those who actually do well despite extreme adversity, that typically a major difference in their lives is that they've had a trusting adult somewhere in there, whether it be a grandparent, a teacher, an older friend, that they can trust. And that really makes a huge difference in their lives.
And how do you start to measure whether what you're doing is working?
We have very much of a variety of ways of doing that, everything from talking with children, talking with teachers, talking with parents. We've increasingly been looking at physiological outcome, and an article I'm working on right now with my colleague Melissa Sturge-Apple is looking at how an early intervention decreased parenting stress, and that in turn normalized the stress endocrine functioning in these mothers, which down the road, we hope, has a continued positive effect on their parenting and also on their health and well-being.
You birth to age 5, you have child-parent psychotherapy, right?
Correct.
Tell me about that.
We work with the primary caregiver and the child together. If there are multiple children, we involve everybody. If the grandparents, the primary caregiver, she's involved. And it's really looking at, in many of these traumatized families, the really negative effects that early childhood adversity for the parent have exerted on the parent and on the parent's caregiving. It emanated from a model called Ghosts in the Nursery, talking about how your early childhood affects who you are and your parenting. And there's a lovely article out there more recently called Angels in the Nursery, which talks about how early positive caregiving also can be transmitted intergenerationally.
You're nodding right away there, Jerome.
You know, in particular, what Sherry mentioned in terms of a caring adult, our listeners and, you know, certainly our panel have probably heard of the 40 developmental assets, you know, which is pretty much a safety net we want to have around our children, you know, because it could be the lunch lady in school. It could be the bus driver. It could be, you know, the guy down at the rec center. But to have someone or someones, if you will, that young man, young lady can confide in and trust in, it builds resilience. So, yes, that's what I was nodding because back to what we were saying earlier, this takes the village approach, you know, because, first of all, the awareness. You know, and again, thanks for having us on for this topic because it's serious enough that we need to Jeff's point, so what do we do? And the strategies that Sheree is talking about and what we're doing in schools and what we're doing in rec centers, the collaborations. As a matter of fact, the meeting I have after this is with our colleagues from the Department of Human Services. You know, thank you, Kelly. Thank you, Nancy Forrest, to talk about some specific families at one of our schools and how we're going to do some Tier 3 work with them, including those families' exposure to violence, all to get at having our kids in school on a more regular basis, which is ultimately going to improve their academic and economic outcome all the way down the road. So it's highly interrelated. And so that's why you see me nodding my head. There's a lot of good work happening. We want more people to join in because it impacts all of us and it impacts all of us deeply.
In Honeoye, this is Wes. Go ahead, Wes.
Yes. Good afternoon, everybody. Just have a question for Mr. Underwood, and also a comment probably to the panel. Mr. Underwood, if you could just take a few minutes, a few moments, and just clarify the anecdote or the Mount Reed incident. If I was a suburban resident, I would be a little bit concerned that the threat, and I don't think you meant it that way, regarding city residents, that everybody needs to participate or those incidents are coming our way. So I'm not sure if you meant that as a threat, but if you can just take a few moments and clarify the point of your anecdote. Just a comment to the panel, real quick. I don't want to take up a lot of time. I worked in the D.C. suburbs, New York City suburbs, Spring Valley, also Baltimore, Randallstown. Almost the majority of the people in those areas were a mixture of African-American and Puerto Rican. And I, again, this is a big assumption on my part. It's merely an observation, and it's really not a question to the panel, but something to think about. Most of the CEOs, board members that serve in family, I guess, anti-poverty program, family programs, tend to represent the people that they serve. And many of those organizations also have boards, and they try to make sure that 25 to 50% of the board members also represent, to some degree, the people that they do serve. I struggle with Monroe County, Rochester. I know it's a Republican conservative district, et cetera, et cetera. And there just doesn't seem to be a lot of opportunities and programs that serve people who are impoverished, where the CEOs, some of the board members reflect the people that they do serve. Again, it's just a comment on my part. I know in Spring Valley, New York, I know in Randallstown, New York, outside of Baltimore, they seem to do very, very well with working with the folks, and there seems to be a lot of opportunities for poor and middle-class people to get together, work together. They even organize their school in that way, and I know, Evan, you talk a lot about, in terms of education, you talk a lot about North Carolina and what they're doing and
right.
What's down there. I'll stop right there, and Mr. Underwood, I'll wait to hear your comment.
Thank you, Wes. Go ahead.
Sure. Thank you for the question. Certainly not a threat. What we were talking about is the issue that this violence and the impact of violence against children is not concentrated to the city of Rochester, even though there is concentrated poverty in Rochester and violence as well is concentrated in a number of our zip codes. What I was trying to do, with obviously I didn't do it clearly enough, is illustrate using the example I did that, you know, the impact trickles out, if you will, and it also trickles in, you know, so certainly not a threat, but the goal of having everyone aware, and if they so choose, to be part of the solution rather than just us talking about it.
Well, an example it comes to mind for me, and Jerome, you can tell me if this is part and parcel of what we're talking about here. I was talking to a woman I know. She's a suburban mother, has, I think, a five-year-old. And she's one of the gentlest people you ever meet, and her husband might be even gentler. And she said he came home the other day, and yeah, he didn't like something, and he kind of threw something violently. And she said, I'm saying, where did you learn that? You know, and well, there's a kid at school who does that. And this is not in the city of Rochester. It's not in an impoverished spot. But the point is, when there is violence, you can't just live in a bubble and, well, there's no violence in my household. My kids will never experience it. There will never be any impact. Violence impacts all of us in some way, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And that's just a small glimpse of that.
Absolutely, and there's another great example and illustration of what we're talking about. You know, kids learn, and they're pediatricians and folks with PhDs on the other end of the table, but they learn by, you know, replicating what they see, regardless of where they see it. It could be television, it could be video games,
yeah.
It could be in a comic book, you know, and I think it is arguable that there's a lot of violence all around us, you know. So where, you know, children who are not experiencing violence in their household and all of a sudden, what may seem like all of a sudden, choose to act out violently, where that comes from needs investigating, you know. So it's certainly not, none of us are immune to that, but there are certainly concentrations and more frequency in certain locations. And there's a lady who called in earlier talking about this whole issue and how it affects, how it impacts rural areas. She's exactly correct. We all face it, and we all should, in my opinion, look to see, well, what can we do to reduce the long-term effects on it. Jeff talked about your physical health could be impacted by, you know, this vicarious trauma. You know, back to the city again, where, you know, somebody wrote an article, I think it was last year sometime, about death by zip code. you know, and talking about the level of health care we have and the disparate nature of health care for, as it turns out, poor, but certainly Black and Latino people in the city, where, again, there's the concentration of violence and, you know, that ripple effect. To the caller's last point, we know that the anti-poverty work has just begun in Rochester, when I say just begun, in the past 6 months, and there's a lot of conversation about the point that he was making. Jeff is on co-chair of one of the work groups. Yours truly is on the Safe Neighborhoods work groups as well. So we're doing a lot of work in anti-poverty, and this exact topic is a main topic in terms of, you know, because poverty and violence, there's a whole lot of overlap to that, and disparate health care and disparate employment, they seem to reside in the very same places.
And to Jerome's point, Jeff, Dr. Kazareski, you said earlier, and I just want to reemphasize the point, when we talk about violence in a child's life, we're talking about long-term health impacts that you might not immediately associate. You said heart disease, for example, things like that?
Yeah, so there's this remarkable study that the CDC is involved with, the Center for Disease Control. You know, the Center for Disease Control used to work on infectious diseases. It still does. But violence is our new polio. And we need that sense of urgency about this. Because what happens is violence gets under the skin, and it influences our health for a lifetime. And that is incredibly expensive. When you think about heart disease as the leading cause of death, and start to think violence causes heart disease. And then further, in terms of Jerome's metaphor of the tip of the iceberg, when you think about cost, what does this do to our communities? Like the city of Rochester, in terms of lost community development, lost productivity of individuals. The health and cost, in addition to the moral consequences of violence, are undeniable. And it's so common that we have to focus more on prevention, and prevention with the urgency that we once attacked polio. Our CDC, our Center for Disease Control, is starting to orient us in that way.
Susan writes an email to the program, thanks for having this important conversation. What does the research show about violence in relation to violent video games and movies? Is there research on that? I know that question's come up many times in the past. Dr. Kazareski or Sherry, I don't know if there's research on that subject.
Yeah. Albert Schweitzer said something that Jerome says all the time, you know, example isn't the main way of influencing people, it's the only way. And what we have as a problem with videos and movies is that what kids see are examples of people behaving violently. And oftentimes those are kids, the video games can be incredibly lifelike these days. You almost think you're experiencing it. And in movies, you know, the example of their, you know, of a role model for them, of a favorite, you know, person who they'd like to be like, being involved with violence has impact. So, yes, movies and video games are examples of violent behavior that kids will replicate. I think there's less strength to that connection than there is for real people. Real communities, seeing someone shot on the street, watching a parent be beaten, that's of another magnitude. But it all fits in that category of examples and influencing behavior.
Sherry Toth, before we wrap the program then this hour, again, if you're just joining us, Sherry is the director of the Mount Hope Family Center, and there are so many things happening there that are already impacting kids. The question is, how do we get more kids in to see you? How do we create more resources to help these kind of kids? How do we create more success stories? I want to ask our panel what you want to leave the audience with, because we want to try to be hopeful. I've been hearing from listeners this hour who are really down about this, and I understand that. But what can we do? Let's kind of wrap on a hopeful note.
I think the glass is half full. We have things out there that we know work. We have an incredible amount of passion in this community with people, I think, that are trying to come together to come up with solutions. I think the Anti-Poverty Initiative holds great hope if we can move in the right direction. I think the relation between trauma and economic disadvantage is huge, and that needs to be part of that initiative.
Yep.
I just wanted to make a quick point about Jerome's comment about health disparities. Mm-hmm. I think we need to do more and more in terms of getting out of our ivory tower offices and getting out there into the communities. That's what we do at Mount Hope. We do home-based work. It decreases the stigma associated with seeking services for many populations, and I think that's critical.
And the last comment I'll get in this hour is Mark writes to the program, just condensing, said that a child he knows through his child's circle of friends, he's reasonably certain is being exposed to violence, if not on a daily basis, at least a weekly basis, can't go into the home and remove them. What to do? Dr. Kazarowski, what would you say to Mark?
He needs to let someone know. He needs to report that to social services, the Child Protective Services at the county needs to report that. It turns out it's often not effective actually to remove kids from their families. Most parents want to be good parents. They just may not be able to do it because of their own childhoods. But there's a lot we can do to help that family. There's a lot that Jerome does. There's a lot that Sherry does to help that family and heal that.
Jerome, some final thoughts from you, about 20 seconds.
If you can't change your mind, you can't change anything. I've learned that. And hopefully what we've been able to do here today is change people's minds about this. And hopefully that changing of the mind first will then lead to a change in behavior and change in action where they join some of the things that Sherry have talked about. Come talk to us at the school district, see how people can get involved. And together we can make something, good things happen.
I think of Mark's email and you think, well, it should be obvious if you think a child might be exposed to violence. But sometimes it's... And I'm not disparaging Mark. It's easier to do nothing, to think about your own family. And it's hard sometimes to kind of make that call. But what we're hearing is, you know, we all can be involved, I think, and make sure kids are growing up outside of violence, away from violence, as healthy as possible. And I want to thank our panel, Jerome Underwood from the City of Rochester School District. Thank you very much for your work. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sherry Toth, the director of the Mount Hope Family Center. Great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Jeff Kazarowski, Children's Agenda. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Evan.
Thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.